We stopped at slide 9, I believe. I really just introduced the notion of membrane potentials. Membrane potential is a voltage. All potentials are voltages when used in this way. And remember that there are three types. There's a resting membrane potential. There are graded or local potentials. And there are action potentials. Now, they're all voltages, but they're different for certain reasons. One thing that's important to understand is that there is always a higher concentration of potassium ions in the intracellular fluid and a higher concentration of sodium ions in the extracellular fluid compared to the other fluid. All right, and what maintains those gradients? The continuous action of the sodium-potassium exchange pumps that are embedded in the plasma membranes of all your cells. Those pumps operating for your whole lifetime take up about 40% of the energy that you eat in order to obtain. All right, so I'm going to explain in a second how the resting membrane potential works, but and therefore you'll understand how these graded and action potentials work. But slide 10 compares the graded and action potentials. The graded potentials, remember, are also called local potentials. And that's because they occur just at a specific place on a plasma membrane. So it's not the entire membrane has this same value of voltage in a graded potential. It's locally occurring. Action potentials are local for the moment, but they propagate down the length of an axon or a myofiber, because muscle cells also conduct action potentials. But notice the difference here. The type of signal for a graded potential is an input signal. That graded potentials are the things that cause action potentials. Action potentials need to have some other voltage change occur in order for an action potential to begin. But action potential's job, once the action potential is triggered, is to send a signal, propagate down the length of the neuron, and therefore send information to the other end of the neuron. The action potential ultimately is going to allow the release of a chemical signal from the end of the neuron, from the synaptic terminal. Yeah. Yeah. But it's good to remind me. So as far as neurons concerned, these graded potentials are occurring at dendrites, or in some cases the cell body itself, the receiving end of the neuron. Action potentials begin at the trigger zone, which is at the axon hillock, and then they propagate down the length of the axon. Action potentials maintain their strength. They don't die out as they travel down the length. That's not true of graded potentials. They dissipate. Okay? The types of gated ion channels involved, well, it's various for graded potentials. They can be either mechanically gated, operated by being squeezed or pulled, deformed somehow. They can be ligand-gated based on something binding to the channel, or they can be voltage-gated based on what the membrane potential is at that moment, will open or close a gate. Action potentials operate via just voltage-gated channels because it's a voltage, like I said, it's a graded potential, which is a voltage, that sparks an action potential. So they're always voltage-gated channels. The ions that move through these channels that cause these changes in voltage are usually, as you see, sodium chloride or potassium. I mean, sodium ions, chloride ions, or calcium ions in the case of graded potential. Action potentials involve, in neurons at least, involve only sodium and potassium ions. So there are voltage-gated sodium ion channels, voltage-gated potassium ion channels. Both of those things are involved in creating a single action potential, which we'll discuss. Type of signal. Notice that for potentials, there can be either depolarizing or hyperpolarizing. What it means to be polarized is for there to be a difference from one place to another, right? There are two poles that are different from each other. In the case of a membrane potential, it's polarized when there is some voltage. In other words, when there is more positive charge on one side and more negative charge on the other side. That's polarization. And that's the situation at rest. The resting membrane potential is a voltage. Zero voltage would be not totally non-polarized, right? But the resting cell has a voltage. It happens to be negative with respect to the inside, so there's a negative millivolt value to the resting membrane potential. So a local potential is a change in the membrane potential from rest. If that change is such that it makes the inside even more negative, then it's making that membrane even more polarized. So that's called a hyperpolarizing potential. If it makes it less negative, it's making it less polar, and that's called a depolarizing potential. So graded potentials can go in either direction, in other words, as far as graphing them is concerned, as far as the voltage is concerned. Whereas action potentials are always depolarizing, well, at least the beginning of the action potential is. There's a depolarization phase and a repolarization phase, which we'll look at, but it starts out as a depolarization. All action potentials are basically the same. The strength of the stimulus is another difference. The reason that these graded potentials are called graded is because graded means that they can vary in magnitude or strength. In other words, there are such things as strong graded potentials compared to other graded potentials that aren't as strong. There can be weak and strong graded potentials in either direction, either hyperpolarizing or depolarizing. Whereas action potentials are said to be all or none. That means that either they get spurred into existence or they don't. So if the graded potential that's trying to create an action potential is not strong enough, there will be no action potential at all. That's the none part. If it is strong enough, then any action potential that's created is the same magnitude as any other that's created for that given neuron. That's the all part. So there's no weak or strong action potentials. There's either action potentials or no action potentials. Ions entering the cell through channels is what initiates the signal for graded potentials. Now, ions are involved for action potentials as well, but there is a so-called threshold voltage that must be reached for an action potential to occur, and that's why they're all or none. So the graded potential changes the membrane potential, and if it happens to be a depolarizing potential, then it's going to change it by increasing the voltage, by making it less negative. That's going to bring it up toward a special voltage called the threshold voltage, which is the switch. It's the special voltage that causes the voltage-gated sodium ion channels that are involved in the action potential to open up. And when they do that, that's what begins the action potential. So unless you get that membrane potential to rise from resting value up to the threshold value, you will not get an action potential. That's that change from resting up to threshold is what the job of a depolarizing graded potential is. That's why they cause action potentials. There's no minimum level required to initiate graded potentials, meaning that's another way of saying they're graded, really. A very small stimulus will cause a very small magnitude graded potential, but a very small graded action or graded potential is going to be unlikely to cause an action potential because it won't change the membrane potential enough. It won't get it up to threshold, whereas there is a threshold for action potentials. And we'll talk about summation, the two signals summing together or adding together when we get a good, better figure at it. For graded potentials, there's no restrictions on summing together different potentials. Action potentials can sum to a certain extent, but they're limited by what is called a refractory period, which I'll explain. Okay? And this bottom point is important. The nervous system becomes because the nervous system sends its signals over long distances as action potentials, which I just got done telling you are all or none, it's impossible for the nervous system to send information about a strong stimulus in the form of a strong action potential, right? The neurons have to tell the brain, for instance, sensory neurons have to tell the brain, this stimulus is strong. I just got punched, not caressed. So the brain has to know the difference. But since all action potentials are the same strength, it can't send a strong action potential to the brain to indicate that it was a punch versus a caress. So the nervous system encodes strong stimuli as not strong action potentials, but rather a higher frequency of action potentials. So a single stimulus usually causes multiple action potentials, one after another. And if they occur very frequently, meaning one after another, spaced very close in time, then that tells the brain that's a strong stimulus. Figure 11 is actually a figure from chapter 5. There aren't really very good pictures in this particular book to explain the basis of the resting membrane potential, but what you have working, there's a lot of things at play that contribute to the resting membrane potential. But the most important things are the fact that there is sodium-potassium exchange pump work, well, many pumps within each cell. All these sodium-potassium exchange pumps are continuously working. That's what maintains a strong gradient with respect to sodium and potassium ions. Those gradients are in opposite directions, meaning that sodium ions are pumped out of the cell and potassium ions are pumped into the cell. Now that's using energy, of course. That's why there are pumps. They're moving these things in the opposite direction compared to how they would like to diffuse. So there's always a strong tendency for sodium to want to diffuse back into the cell and potassium to want to diffuse back out the cell, right, down their own concentration gradients. But these things don't go through the phospholipid bilayer because they're ions, so they have to have some way to diffuse. Well, there happen to be quite a few non-gated potassium ion channels in the membrane. So you spend this energy in the form of ATP to pump potassium ions into the cell. And then you allow some of those potassium ions to leak right back out through non-gated ion channels. But this is important because this is the basis of, this is the biggest part of the basis of this resting membrane potential. Let's imagine what happens when you have these potassium ions coming into the cell and sodium ions going out. When the potassium start, notice these are both cations, these are both positive ions, so you're really not changing anything electrically when you swap sodium for potassium. But when you let potassium ions leak out of the cell again, you're having positives leave the cell. All right? When you have positives leave the cell, there are negative ions inside the cell, which the principal one are chloride ions, but there are also proteins within the cell which have a slight negative charge because of the way they fold up. And those negative particles want to follow the positives because negatives and positives attract each other. All right? The only thing is the negatives can't get through the membrane. So they try to follow the potassiums that are leaving, but they get left behind at the inside surface of the plasma membrane. That's why the inside surface of the plasma membrane is more negative than the outside. Because not only that, but the potassiums that are leaving, once there's enough of them leaving and you have a crowd of negatives locked on the inside, those potassiums are attracted back to them, so the positives tend to line up on the exterior surface of the membrane. Does that make sense? Does it not? Well, when you have positives lined up on the outside and negatives lined up on the inside, you have an unequal distribution of charge. That is a voltage. Okay? That's the transmembrane potential, or the membrane potential at rest. That is the resting membrane potential. Well, the potassium ions are being affected by two different forces at the same time. There is an electrical, there's a chemical force, that is the force for diffusion. That is trying to force potassium ions out of the cell. And that force of diffusion is in the form of its gradient, right? That's what the pump sets up. The higher the concentration is inside the cell of potassium ions, the more tendency there is for them to leave by diffusion. So that's trying to push them out. But as more of them go out and the negatives line up trying to follow them, the more they are electrostatically attracted back in. So there's an electrical tendency for potassium to come back in and a chemical tendency for them to go out. When those two, and those are in opposite directions, when those two forces exactly equal each other, it comes to equilibrium. And it comes to equilibrium at about negative 70 millivolts or so. That's why that's what the resting membrane potential is. But notice that it would not occur if it weren't for the continuous operation of a sodium-potassium exchange pumps. All right? And so because of these non-gated potassium ion channels and the sodium-potassium exchange pumps and some other reasons that aren't really important right now, it comes to equilibrium at negative 70 millivolts or so for most neurons. And until there is some sort of change made. How would you change the membrane potential? You change it automatically whenever you allow the transfer of ions, anything charged, through the membrane. Because those charges that reside on those particles are the voltage, the difference in those charges from one side to the other. That is the voltage. So if you were to rearrange the distribution of charged particles across the membrane, you change the voltage. So a local potential is simply results from a redistribution of ions from the status at rest. Okay? Slide 12 shows you the difference between, it shows you a change in membrane potential. The horizontal or level part of the red line at first, notice, isn't changing. So the membrane potential is at about negative 70 millivolts, like I said. That's the resting membrane potential. Now that doesn't mean nothing's happening. There's all kinds of movement of ions. It's just come to equilibrium, so there's no change in the charge distribution. But then notice that there's this depolarization phase, which is a rise in the membrane potential. The voltage goes up towards zero. That's making it less polarized. Zero would be nonpolar, right? No voltage. So when it goes towards zero, that's getting rid of some of the polarity. That's why a change in that direction is called a depolarization. A repolarization brings it back farther down toward resting. A hyperpolarization makes it even more polar than it is at rest. Makes the inside even more negative. And it's negative inside because that's where those negative ions are lining up. Okay? Well, slide 13 shows you anatomically what's going on when there is a graded potential being created. This is a synapse that you're looking at here. So that axon terminal is from some upstream neuron. And its job, of course, is to release a neurotransmitter. The effect in this case of the neurotransmitter is to open up sodium ion channels in the downstream cell, this larger part of the bottom part of this figure is the downstream cell, the postsynaptic cell, which itself could be another neuron. Okay? But if, in this example, the effect is to open up sodium ion channels in the plasma membrane of the postsynaptic cell. So, since they're open now, sodium ions suddenly have a way to diffuse. Why do they want to diffuse? Because what fills that cleft, that synaptic cleft, is extracellular fluid. It's not in either of these two cells, right? And what do you know about extracellular fluid with respect to sodium ions? It has a much higher concentration than the intracellular fluid of any cells does. And therefore, when these gates are suddenly open, sodium naturally diffuses down its own gradient and from the synaptic cleft into the cell. Well, sodium ions are positive ions, so allowing them into the cell that has a resting membrane potential to begin with is suddenly making that inside more positive. You're importing positive charges. That's why it depolarizes the membrane potential. Okay? And another thing that's illustrated here by these arrows is that these local or graded potentials occur at one place, but then they travel some distance. The thing is, as they travel, they dissipate. So they get weaker and weaker as they travel along the surface. So you could measure, if you had electrodes, the strongest measurement you would get would be right there where those gates are opened. But you would get a less strong rise from resting a little farther away. If you measured it far enough away, you would get no change in the membrane potential. So that's a big difference between graded potentials and action potentials. Graded potentials fizzle out, basically, in space and in time. And I guess that's shown in slide 14 graphically here. Depending on where you measure things, it will be weaker or stronger. This is the same stimulus, just being measured at three different places on the left side. Notice that when you measure it up toward the point of stimulus, that it is above that dashed line. That dashed line is the threshold voltage. That's the special voltage that is going to allow the opening of voltage-gated sodium ion channels that are going to be responsible for an action potential. We haven't gotten there yet. Okay, those are different from the sodium ion channels that were opened up to cause this graded potential. So not all sodium ion channels are alike. But if you measure it close to the place where action potentials are started, if they are going to be started, which is down at the trigger zone, notice that because of the dissipation of the local potential, it no longer is at threshold. So in this case, there would be no action potential created. It's the none part of all or none. On the other hand, a stronger stimulus is going to cause a stronger graded potential, which by the time it travels the distance of the cell body would still be strong enough to be above threshold at the axon hillock. That's the right part of the figure. And so this stimulus would cause an action potential, because all you have to do to create any action potential is change the membrane potential to threshold. You don't have to go above threshold. You have to just meet threshold. You can go above threshold, but it doesn't create a bigger action potential. That's the all part of all or none. So what happens during an action potential? Well, slide 15 illustrates in red a single action potential. Notice that's membrane potential versus time. So a single action potential has that shape. All right, this, on the bottom, that's ion permeability. So there's three different things here. There's voltage in the dashed lines, but the two solid lines are ion permeabilities of these two important ions, sodium and potassium. Both of these ions are involved in action potentials. Okay? And so there are two different kinds of gated ion channels. There are voltage-gated sodium ion channels, and there are voltage-gated potassium ion channels. Of course, each one is specific for its kind of ion. So when it's open, only that kind of ion gets through, not the other one. When they're closed, of course, nothing gets through. Both of these kind of channels are activated by the threshold voltage. That's what makes them voltage-gated. It's not a ligand binding to them that opens them up. It's a special voltage that has to be applied across the membrane that will open them up. And that is the threshold voltage. And both of these things start opening when the threshold voltage is met. But sodium ion channels open up a lot quicker than potassium ion channels. They snap right open. It takes a little bit of time for potassium ion channels to open up. And that's good. All right? The reason that is because you have to have a depolarization phase for the action potential to be created. That upswing toward the peak from 2 to 5 is called the depolarization phase of an action potential. And that's caused because the threshold voltage, actually I should have said from 3 to 5, I'm sorry. That's caused because threshold is met. So the region between 2 and 3, notice that 2 is still at rest. Nothing has changed yet. But some stimulus has been applied, okay, like being touched or photon hitting an eye or something like that. That stimulus causes a local potential. So the little section of red from 2 to 3 is a local graded potential. And this one happens to be a depolarizing local potential because it's an upswing, right? That's the only kind of graded potential that can ever cause an action potential. Because an action potential requires getting up to threshold. The only way you're going to get there is if you go up, not down. So that's a depolarizing local potential that's occurring from 2 to 3. And this one happens to be sufficiently large to get it up to threshold. That local potential is caused by some sort of ion channel that we can't tell by looking at this. It might be a sodium ion, it might be a voltage-gated sodium ion channel itself, but it might also be a ligand-gated sodium ion channel. In any case, those channels that are causing the graded potential are totally different from the proteins that serve as the voltage-gated sodium ion channels that are sprung into action by that threshold. Okay, so you have all kinds of different proteins in your cells, including all kinds of different channels, ion channels. Anyway, if this threshold is met, which it is, then that causes both the voltage-gated sodium ion channels and the voltage-gated potassium ion channels to start opening. The sodium ones pop right open quickly. So now all of a sudden you have a bunch of holes in the cell membrane through which sodium ions can travel down their gradient by diffusion. And that's into the cell because that's the way the gradient always is because of the sodium-potassium exchange pumps. So now you have a massive influx of sodium ions. That's making the inside of the cell much more positive. That's why it's a steep upswing on the graph during the depolarization phase. Now, sodium ions, notice that the more sodium ions that come in, the more positive it gets. And the more positive it gets, the more above threshold it is. So that's kind of a positive feedback mechanism. There has to be something that turns off these sodium ions. Well, it happens that sodium ion channels have two gates on them, a so-called activation gate and an inactivation gate. So the activation gate opens up first, right at threshold. The inactivation gate closes a little bit later, and that's why it peaks out. That's why it doesn't continue getting higher. And so that's the basis of the fact that all action potentials are the same magnitude, because those inactivation gates keep it from going any higher. All right? Well, that explains why the closure of the sodium ion channels explains why it doesn't get any higher. But what makes it come back down has nothing to do with sodium ions. What makes it come back down is by then, you know, just a millisecond later, these comparatively slower potassium ion channels that started opening up at the same time comparatively slower potassium ion channels started opening right away, but now they are fully open at this peak. So now you don't have sodium ions flowing because their inactivation gates are closed, and you do have potassium ion channels open, which allows diffusion of potassium. But diffusion of potassium is in the opposite direction because the gradient is in the opposite direction. In other words, potassium ions flow out of the cell. They're also positive ions, though. So now you're exporting positives from the cell. That leaves the interior more negative. That's why it brings it back down. And that downswing in the action potential graph is called the repolarization phase of the action potential. Notice that it also overshoots at the bottom. The lower dashed line there is the resting membrane potential. And at the end of the action, or toward the end of the action potential, it actually goes even more polar than it was at rest. Books call this different things. Some call it the after potential. But in any case, it goes lower than resting. And the reason that that's true is for the same reason that, well, it's for the same slowness reason. Potassium ion channels are slow to open, but they're also slow to close. So as it comes back down and reaches resting membrane potential again, there are still some open channels that are slow to close, and you still have some more potassium ions leaving the cell, so it gets even more polar. But then once all of these action potential related potassium ion channels are closed, then you have the equilibrium reestablished involving the pumps and the non-gated potassium ion channels, the ones that are responsible for the resting membrane potential. That's why it comes back to equilibrium at rest at the end. Now that is one action potential, and we tend to describe action potentials as traveling down the length of an axon. It really is not true. Action potentials, when signals are propagated down the axon, what you really have is a series of individual action potentials, each occurring locally, but it's a chain reaction. One action potential at the axon hillock, which is where the first one is created, is a stimulus to cause an action potential right beside it in the next little piece of plasma membrane. And then that's going to cause one next to it, and so on. So it's really a series of action potentials all the way down the length. But since they're all equal magnitude, that explains why action potentials don't dissipate. They regenerate as they go along, and they're just as strong at the end as they were at the axon hillock. Now, 16 gives you a real close-up view of what's happening in the membrane. There's thousands and thousands of these channels, but we're just looking at one right here, and this is a voltage-gated sodium ion channel. Notice that it has two gates. One gate is that ball and chain apparatus, and it's open at rest. But no sodium ions are flowing in through these at resting potential because the other gate, the activation gate, is closed. All right? If the threshold voltage, whatever causes that, whatever brings the membrane to threshold, which would be some sort of local depolarizing potential, that's what snaps open that activation gate. And so now both gates are open. That's when sodium ions flow. They flow into the cell because that's the way the gradient is poignant. And that makes the inside more positive. That's why you have the pluses now lining the interior surface in yellow versus the negatives on the outside. All right? But just a fraction of a second after that activation gate opens in response to the threshold, the inactivation gate closes. And that's what prevents more sodium ions to come in. Otherwise, it would keep going positive, more and more positive, because there's still a strong gradient. There's still plenty of gradient left over to make more sodium ions flow if they were allowed. They're just not allowed because of the inactivation gates. And then after the action potential on part E here, things are reset to where they were originally. The inactivation gate gets reopened and the activation gate gets reclosed. It's ready to undergo another action potential. So slide 17 illustrates this positive feedback mechanism that sodium ions operate by. Positive feedback because the flow of potassium ions causes depolarization. Depolarization causes sodium ions to open up, sodium ion channels to open up. That's why it's positive feedback. So there needs to be a negative feedback mechanism in place to stop that, just like for all positive feedback mechanisms. They need to be temporary and they need to be supplanted by a negative feedback mechanism. So it's inactivation gates that close them. That's why they have to have two gates. The potassium ion channels need only one gate because flow of potassium ion channels repolarize or hyperpolarize things. So they will turn themselves off automatically. Slide 18 brings it all together with both individual ion types being graphed simultaneously. The sum of these two curves, sodium and the potassium curves, is what really makes the action potential. So the overall action potential is the combination of those two different ion curves shown. But notice that the important thing for depolarization phase is the flow of sodium ions. The important thing for the repolarization phase is the flow of potassium ions. Now this next slide, 19, illustrates what I was talking about as far as the coding of strong stimuli by the nervous system. A strong stimulus is going to cause a stronger graded potential. That's what the whole idea of graded is. Graded potentials mean that the strength of the stimulus, the stronger the stimulus, the stronger the potential. So the incoming part of the neuron right away knows that it's a strong stimulus because it creates a strong graded potential because of more flow of ions. But the action potentials that result from that stimulus are identical in magnitude. So a strong stimulus causes a higher frequency of action potentials. And this slide illustrates how that works. Notice that you have membrane, in part A, you have membrane potential graph versus time. And that upward hill in red on the left is the graded potential that occurs as in response to the stimulus. Okay, this one obviously is a depolarizing potential because it's an upswing. Well, threshold isn't actually labeled on there as a dashed line, but threshold is there all the time. I mean, the threshold is just a value that needs to be met. If you imagine that the threshold goes, I mean, the graded potential goes way above threshold rather than just kissing it. If it just kisses it, just one action potential is going to be created, right? But if it goes above threshold, the graded potential, that is, then the moment it hits threshold, it's going to create the first action potential. And if it's still hanging around above threshold a moment later, a second action potential will be created because it's still above threshold. And a third and so on until that original local potential finally dips back down below threshold potential. All right? So these vertical spikes that you see are action potentials. They actually have the action potential shape. It's just they're squeezed into the time scale so tightly that they look like spikes. Notice that you can tell they're action potentials because they're all the same height. They're all the same magnitude. But the spacing is different between A and B. And that's because the membrane potential, the graded potential resulting from the stimulus in B is stronger. So it goes way above threshold, spends more time above threshold, and causes not only a greater number of action potentials, but spaced together in time more. So that stronger stimulus, therefore, was encoded as an increase in frequency of action potentials. That's how the nervous system works. Okay, now there's something behind this that we're going to have to talk about that explains it further, and that's the refractory period. I'll get into that in a minute, though. Slide 20 describes current flow. Current flow refers to longitudinal movement of ions. Okay, now when we're talking about the things, the movement of ions that create voltages, that is transverse movement. Transverse is along the width of something. Longitudinal is along the length. So movement of ions through the membrane is transverse direction. Movement of ions along the length is current flow. And so there's a current flow outside the cell, and there's a current flow inside the cell. All right? And by definition, by convention, we say that current flow is the movement of positive charges. So this yellow section of this axon that we're looking at right here The blue axon has a just a yellow section here that is undergoing an action potential at the moment. So the channels in this little slice of membrane are open, and that's why you have positive inside and negative outside. That this little section of the axon is undergoing its action potential right now. All right? And these positive ions that are now in the inside in the yellow section are attracted electrostatically to the negatives that are on the parts of the axon that are still at rest, which are on either side of it. Okay? That's because positives attract negatives. That's what causes the positives to flow down the length of the axon in both directions. That's local current flow. And on the outside, the positives that are on the outside at rest, resting sections, are attracted to the negatives that are now there at the action potential site. Well, this is important because this local current flow is what acts as a stimulus to cause the next little section of membrane to undergo action potential. Because notice that when these positives in the yellow section move over to the right, this blue section to the right now is going to be positive inside. In other words, it's going to go up to threshold itself. And when it reaches threshold, then its own voltage-gated sodium ion channels are going to pop open and create an action potential on that little slice. And then you're going to have local current flow where positive ions are moved to the next little section, and then it's going to have an action potential. That's how action potentials are propagated, as a chain reaction, one creating the next, and so on down the line. And a good analogy for that is dominoes that you set up. All you have to do as your stimulus is hit that first domino hard enough. That represents reaching threshold. If you hit it hard enough, it's going to tip over, and that's all you have to do. It's going to be automatically propagated until it gets all the way to the end of the line of dominoes. But each individual domino represents an individual action potential, which is an individual yellow slice here. Go ahead. Do they happen at the unmyelinated places?
Yeah.
No, and that's important. Oh, yes, they happen only at the unmyelinated, I'm saying. They don't happen at the myelinated. And this is why myelination really speeds things up. But I'll better explain that when we have a picture to look at it. Slide 21 shows you now the propagation of the action potential. The very first one starts at the axon hillock, and it starts... If it starts because that little piece of membrane has a local potential that is at threshold or above. Okay, and therefore the voltage-gated sodium ion channels are popped open. But local current flow from there on is what continues it along the length. That original graded potential, its only job is to create the first action potential at the axon hillock. Then from there on out, action potentials cause further action potentials. All right, now, importantly, notice that the current flow is in both directions. So the positive ions in this yellow slice in the bottom of this are also moving backward toward the cell body. So you would think that there would be an action potential created there again. In other words, once you get an action potential, you'd think it would be bouncing back and forth all the time. It doesn't, though, because of what is called the refractory period. Refractoriness, being refractory, refers to being comparatively unsensitive, unresponsive. For instance, the refractory period for a male after orgasm makes him unsensitive to further sexual stimulation for a certain number of minutes. He's refractory during that period. A neuron is refractory right after it has been stimulated at threshold. So it takes a little bit of time for these proteins to reset themselves in order to be able to work again. Okay? That's important because it happens to be that the time it takes for them to reset themselves is long enough so that by that time, things have dissipated. The action potentials have have gone farther down the line. In other words, by the time these, by the time this pink section behind the yellow section is out of its refractory period and therefore eligible to fire another action potential, these positive ions are no longer there. But since the blue section in front of the action potential has been at rest for a while, it's not in a refractory period. And so it will always have an action potential created, and therefore action potentials, once they're started, always travel unidirectionally from axon hillock to axon terminal. They don't bounce back. If you were to artificially stimulate an axon, though, at the end of it, at the axon terminal, by electricity, the action potential will flow toward the cell body, because there's nothing special about the architecture of the cell that makes it go from axon hillock to axon terminal. It's caused by the refractory period. This dominoes analogy is shown in 22, and the little electrodes that are being pierced through this axon in the middle give rise to the different readings on a multimeter. And so notice that these different individual action potentials shown in red correspond to the different dominoes. So when we say action potentials travel, they don't really travel. What we really mean is that there's a train of action potentials that are created, and the wave travels. The wave of activity travels. There's two important things that affect the speed of propagation. Propagation is the transmission of the information from axon hillock to axon terminal. So axon potentials, we say, propagate down the length of the axon. And they propagate at a certain speed. There's two important characteristics that affect that speed. One is whether or not the axon is myelinated. Remember that myelination consists in either a neurolemmocyte or Schwann cell in the peripheral nervous system wrapping around the axon, or in the central nervous system an oligodendrocyte wrapping several times around the axon. Those are myelin sheaths. That's a myelinated axon. If it's myelinated, propagation speed is drastically increased. If it's not myelinated, it's slower. But the other important characteristic is the diameter of the axon. Larger diameter axons have less resistance to local current. In other words, there's not as much inhibiting these positive ions to flow longitudinally through the fluid in a bigger diameter axon than there is in a smaller diameter axon. So the next action potential created as a result of that local current happens more quickly, and therefore the dominoes fall faster, basically. Okay, so what you see here in this slide 23 is a squid giant axon. It's not an axon of a giant squid. It's a squid's giant axon. It has an axon that's really much bigger than other axons and therefore is very quick. So they've evolved this rather than myelination to increase propagation speed. By the way, there's nothing saying you can't combine the two things. So the very fastest axons are myelinated plus large diameter. The slowest axons are unmyelinated and small in diameter. Well, why does myelination increase propagation speed of action potentials? That's what's being illustrated in figure 24. These yellowish things are individual myelin sheaths along the length of the axon. Remember that an axon can't be entirely myelinated. It's not just one long myelin sheath on a myelinated axon. It's several different myelin sheaths, each one contributed to from a different oligodendrocyte or neurolemmocyte. But in between those individual myelin sheaths are these little gaps, remember, that are called nodes of Ranvier. And those are little bare spots where the neurolemma, where the plasma membrane of the neuron is exposed to the extracellular fluid. Of course, the plasma membrane of the axon is continuous all the way down the length. It exists, but it's being covered by the myelin sheaths where there are myelin sheaths. And therefore, where it's covered by myelin, there's no flow of ions through the membrane there. That's why these myelin sheaths are said to electrically insulate the axon at those places. But there have to be these nodes of Ranvier, because without flow of ions through the membrane, you don't have a redistribution of charge, and therefore you don't have a change in voltage. Without a change in voltage, you can't have an action potential, because an action potential is a change in the membrane voltage. So that's why these nodes of Ranvier have to exist. You have to have flow of sodium and potassium ions through the membrane somewhere. But what the myelin sheaths do is space out where these action potentials are occurring. In an unmyelinated axon, the chain reaction is such that the very next tiny little slice of plasma membrane is going to undergo an action potential right after the previous one does. So there has to be many dominoes, basically, spaced closely together. In a myelinated axon, the local current is able to flow farther because there are no channels opening up that allow those positive ions out or in. Okay, so the local current flows from one node of Ranvier, which has just undergone an action potential, through the myelinated part of the axon without dissipating as much because there's no open channels. And it's still enough, those positive ions that travel to the next node of Ranvier are still enough to bring that next little node of Ranvier up to threshold and therefore cause an action potential there. So action potentials in a myelinated axon appear to leap from node of Ranvier to node of Ranvier. And the word for leaping is saltation. That's why action potential propagation in a myelinated axon is referred to as saltatory conduction of action potentials. So in the domino analogy, it would be like spacing dominoes out farther. Now notice there's a limit to that, though. If you space dominoes out farther, you can use fewer dominoes to get from one end of the table to the other. But if you space them out with gaps that are longer than the height of a domino, then that domino, when it falls, is not going to hit the next domino, right? And that the wave is going to stop. That's why there is an upper limit to the length of a myelin sheath. You can space these nodes of Ranvier out only so much. And so evolution has optimized this. These myelin sheaths are about as long as they can be. The nodes of Ranvier are spaced out about as much as they can be and still ensure that there's going to be an action potential at the next node. Still ensure that there is propagation all the way from the axon hillock to the axon terminal. But the more they're spaced out, the faster it is. So that's why it's optimized. And that's why it's a hell of a big increase in propagation speed if they are myelinated. All right, does that make sense, the myelination? Okay, then let's change gears a little bit and look at slide 25. This is a close-up of a chemical synapse. This is a chemical synapse as opposed to an electrical synapse. Why? Because it's involving the release of a chemical signal. It's not the direct flow of ions from one cell to another. That's what occurs at an electrical synapse. At an electrical synapse, you have direct flow of a direct propagation of action potential from the one cell to the other cell. That doesn't occur usually because electrical synapses are the vast minority. Most synapses are the chemical variety shown here. And so the first action potential, the action potential that's in the upstream cell or presynaptic cell, that ends at the axon terminal of that presynaptic cell. its job, its immediate job, meaning the thing that it causes directly when that action potential reaches the presynaptic terminal, is the opening of voltage-gated calcium ion channels. Okay, now the action potential, remember, is a voltage. So when that action potential reaches the presynaptic terminal, this bulbous end of the neuron, that piece of plasma membrane that is at that presynaptic terminal is changed in its voltage. It's depolarized. That voltage change opens up special other proteins that are embedded in this piece of plasma membrane called voltage-gated calcium ion channels. As the name implies, these channels open up in response to that voltage, and what they allow through them are calcium ions. Calcium ions are not only also positive ions, like sodium ions, but they are also in greater concentration in the extracellular fluid, like sodium ions are. So when these calcium ions channels are opened up, calcium ions flow from where they're in greater abundance, which is outside of the cell, into the presynaptic terminal. And then what the direct effect of that influx of calcium ions is the exocytotic release of these vesicles that have been stored already in the presynaptic terminal. Exocytotic release means transport via exocytosis, which is, remember, vesicular transport. So the neurotransmitter molecules that this neuron has manufactured ahead of time are being stored a little group at a time in individual vesicles. These vesicles, since they are going to be released into the synapse, are called synaptic vesicles. Synaptic vesicles contain the neurotransmitter, which can be whatever neurotransmitter that neuron makes. Well, they're basically standing there at the ready to be triggered to undergo exocytosis and therefore spill their contents into the synaptic cleft. The chemical signal that causes them to release is calcium coming into the presynaptic terminal. Okay? But what causes those calcium ion channels to open up is the action potential coming down the length of the axon and finally reaching the axon terminal. All right, that's the end of the first action potential. When you have neurotransmitter released exocytotically, it's released into the extracellular fluid because that's what the synaptic cleft is filled with. It's that synaptic cleft. The fluid in there is not in either of these two cells, the upstream or the downstream cell. So it has the same properties as any other extracellular fluid. Okay? That's important. That will be important in a second. But now you have neurotransmitter diffusing over this tiny little cleft. It's not very much distance at all. And I don't know whether I mentioned this when we were talking about diffusion or not, but diffusion works really well over short distances. But it gets exponentially less and less effective as you increase the distance. So you can't rely on diffusion over long distances, but over tiny distances it works very well. And so these neurotransmitters take very, very little time to diffuse across this synaptic cleft where they encounter the receptors that are specific for that neurotransmitter. Those receptors are proteins that are embedded in the plasma membrane of the postsynaptic cell. And that postsynaptic cell can be the dendrite, it can be another neuron, in which case that little area at the synapse is going to be a dendrite. Or it could be some other, it could be a target, it could be an effector organ, a muscle, for instance, or a gland. But in any case, the neurotransmitter is only has one function, to bind to a receptor. Those receptors are proteins in whatever that downstream cell is in the membrane. And what happens when you have the binding of a ligand, in this case a neurotransmitter, to a receptor? You have a conformational change, a change in shape of the membrane, of the protein. Well, often these these receptors that neurotransmitters bind to are themselves ion channels. What functional classification of ion channels would they be? They're ligand-gated because the neurotransmitter is a ligand. They don't open or close unless the ligand is bound or unbound. Okay? So these... that's the general scheme. Let's say for a specific example then that this is the neuromuscular junction. Let's say this is the skeletal, how the skeletal muscles get activated. A motor neuron, a skeletal motor neuron, is the upstream cell. In that specific case, the neurotransmitter that's released in response to the neuronal action potential would be acetylcholine. Okay? Acetylcholine would diffuse across the synaptic cleft and bind to acetylcholine receptors, which are parts of ligand-gated sodium ion channels. So when the acetylcholine binds, it opens up sodium ion channels in the downstream cell, which in this case would be a skeletal muscle fiber, muscle cell. Notice that it's a sodium ion channel that it's opening up. The synaptic cleft is extracellular fluid. So when the sodium ion channels open up, there's going to be an influx of sodium from the synaptic cleft, which is extracellular fluid, into that muscle cell. What does the influx of sodium ions cause as far as the membrane potential is concerned? It causes depolarization because you're putting positives into that downstream cell, right? So that muscle before activation is at resting membrane potential. When the sodium ions come in, that membrane potential is now higher. In other words, it goes up toward threshold. And if there's enough acetylcholine molecules opening up enough sodium ion channels, then enough sodium ions travel in to bring that membrane up to threshold. When that happens, then the entirely different kinds of sodium ion channels, voltage-gated ones, that are also in that same membrane of the muscle cell, open up in response to that threshold and cause the action potential in that muscle cell. And then those travel just the way they do in nerves down the length of the muscle cell. And the ultimate effect of that through mechanism that I'm not going to get into right now is contraction of the muscle. All right? Slide 26 really just puts a schematic representation of this. This red area of the presynaptic terminal's membrane is the part that is at action potential at this moment. But what you see from this is that the direct result of that action potential, the action potential does not directly cause release of neurotransmitter. It directly causes the opening of voltage-gated calcium ion channels at number 2 there. It's the influx of calcium ions into the presynaptic terminal that directly causes the release of neurotransmitters via exocytosis. Okay. So there's a cell response that is, you know, it shouldn't come as a surprise that whatever that postsynaptic cell is has the correct kind of receptors for whatever that presynaptic cell's neurotransmitter is or chemical signal is. That's how neurotransmitters act so locally. Neurotransmitters are released into just this tiny little synaptic cleft and only affect that little piece of cell downstream of it. Whereas a hormone, which also might come from a neuron, by the way, but regardless of its source, a hormone travels throughout the body. Much more global response. It's important for neurotransmitters not to be very long-lasting. They need to be transient in their effects. And that's because it's important for there to be maintained an integrity of the signal. What I mean by that is that if the neuron, if the upstream, the presynaptic neuron, sends a single action potential, in response to a tiny stimulus, then you don't want to exaggerate that signal for the downstream cell. The downstream cell needs to respond appropriately to a tiny little signal. Well, if the neurotransmitters that were released from that one action potential upstream were allowed to hang around, they would continue to cause their response in the downstream cell. And that would be exaggerating the signal, right? So very shortly after neurotransmitters are released and bind to the receptors and have their effect, they are somehow dealt with so that they're inactivated. Some of them are inactivated simply by being lost in the extracellular fluid out of the synaptic cleft, and therefore they don't come into contact with receptors. But some of them are pumped back into the cell, into the presynaptic neuron, so that they can be reused. But notice, pumping implies that you have to spend ATP to do that. Still others are enzymatically degraded. That's really what you're seeing here in slide 27. This happens to be how acetylcholine, which is just one example of a neurotransmitter, is dealt with. Acetylcholine gets its name from the fact that it's a two-part molecule, an acetyl part and a choline part. The choline is CH, the acetyl is A. When they're bound together, that's an acetylcholine molecule, and it can do its job of being a neurotransmitter and therefore bind to a cholinergic receptor. But in the membranes at the synapse are found still other proteins that act as enzymes. These are called acetylcholinesterase in this specific example, which gets its name from the fact that it cleaves acetylcholine molecules into its two constituents. Okay? The choline part of that, is the valuable stuff, basically. So it's worth it for the choline to be pumped back into the cell. The acetate or acetic acid part of that is everywhere because it's a natural byproduct of biosynthetic pathways. So there's plenty of that to go around. The choline's worth pumping back in. But the important thing is that once you cleave it apart into acetate and choline, it no longer can have any more response. It will take another action potential from the neuron to release another vesicle of fresh acetylcholine molecules for there to be a continued or further response in the downstream cell. And there are similar enzymes that do the job of cleaving other kinds of neurotransmitters. That's just a specific example. Well, 28 is one of these summary slides that kind of brings things all together. What it's showing you is that a neurocrine, which is any chemical signal that's released from a neuron, that's a catch-all term. It could be a neurotransmitter or a neuromodulator or a neurohormone. When that chemical signal reaches the target, it can either directly open up channels, that's what's happening at the chemically gated ion channel labeled on the left, and of course, whenever you open up or close, because it actually could close it as well, whenever you change the status of the gate of a chemically gated ion channel, you change the transfer of ions across the membrane, and you therefore directly change what? What are those that ion redistribution cause? The membrane potential. You change the membrane potential directly by this mechanism. And that's what we've been talking about today mostly. But you could also have this neurocrine bind to a protein with a receptor that is not actually causing the opening of a gate directly. It could operate via a G protein mechanism, as is shown on the right. Now that G protein can do one of various things. And one thing that the G protein could do is to go to a nearby ion channel and open it up. So that would have the same effect, but through a slightly different mechanism. Or it could have nothing to do with ion channels. The activated G protein could modify an enzyme, for instance, or some other kind of protein. So that's how you can have different effects in the downstream cell in response to even the same neurocrine could have totally different effects at different cells based on, so the response is not based on what the signal is. The response is based on what the receptor does for that signal. That's why you have different responses in different tissues to the same exact chemical. Uh, 29, I've actually talked about, in a sense, this showing you neurotransmitters being released. See, some of them just don't ever cause any effect because they don't encounter, as they diffuse, they don't know they're supposed to go to a receptor. They diffuse by Brownian motion, which is random. And some of them diffuse out of the way and never actually reach a receptor. Others are enzymatically degraded. So there's really no new information there. Okay, the last slide I want to do today is 43, and this describes the difference between divergent and convergent pathways. To converge is to come together. This is how rivers work. Rivers have tributaries. Rivers don't branch, right? Rivers have tributaries that are smaller riverlets that come together into bigger streams, and then bigger and bigger. So that's convergence, a coming together. That's shown in part B here. A convergent pathway, as far as the nervous system is concerned, is an arrangement of neurons in which there are a greater number of upstream neurons and a smaller number of downstream neurons. A divergent pathway is just the opposite. To diverge is to branch and split apart. So in a divergent neuronal pathway, there are fewer upstream neurons, more downstream neurons. That's straightforward enough, but what implications does this have physiologically? Well, in a convergent pathway, that means that a single effector, which is at the bottom, the thing that's being affected at the end of the line, a muscle or a gland, for instance, could be affected by several different things happening in the brain. Any one of these upstream neurons could cause an effect. Okay, so different parts of the body even could have an effect on a single downstream effector in a convergent pathway. On the other hand, in a divergent pathway, a single upstream stimulus, say a neuron in the brain, could have different effects in different parts of the body because each of these final downstream neurons goes a different place. Okay, that's it.